Hello, I'm Joan. I'm a Canadian family physician who also works as a restorative medical educator, facilitator, and coach. I create spaces that rehumanize the work of healthcare. I'm creating this podcast to remind myself, as well as anyone else working in a helping profession, that when you are working and caring for your human patients, you are the other human in the room. Hello there, healthcare humans. Thank you so much for coming back for another episode of The Other Human in the Room. I am super excited to talk to this particular healthcare human because she's my friend. She doesn't know it, but she's like my parenting role model. So I'm going to come out and say that on the podcast. And kind of a bit of a super role model just generally in life. So I'm very grateful to know her. And she has brought many good things into my life, including specifically the choir that I can't stop talking about that I joined earlier this year. So I have many reasons to be grateful for her existence in my life. And so I thought, what a fun way to thank her by having her come on my podcast and be interviewed. I'm not sure if this is going to be the token of gratitude, Sarah, or if I'll have to actually do something else for you later. But with that, I would love if you introduce yourself to the folks who are listening.
Sure. So my name is Sarah. And, you know, I clearly remember someone telling me when my kids were tiny, you have to pick people who have kids your age, because those are your survival people. Then you have to have people who have kids slightly older than you, because they're the ones that you ask for help and figure out what the heck you're actually supposed to be doing in the future. And then you need friends who have kids younger than you so that you feel better about yourself. And you're like, thank God I'm not there anymore, because that's so hard. And how did I even do that? So it's a mutually beneficial relationship, Joan. Let's just put it that way.
That's great.
I see what you're up to with your kids sometimes. I'm like, oh my God, like, how did I get up at 6 a.m. and have everybody at the library sing along for 8:30 and snacks and diapers? And geez, Louise, this is crazy. Yeah, so that's, you are as beneficial to me as I am to you. It's very important to have that in your life. So you'd asked me how I got into medicine. So I think a big part of my story is I grew up in a very small town in Ontario. So total like white girl, small town Ontario, and liked it but didn't love it. And once I graduated, I went to the big city. So I went to McGill for my undergrad, and that was really, that just changed everything. I never really went back to my small area. And in fact, my parents have moved away from there. So I keep in touch with some people, but I don't really have a lot of connections back there. But I ended up back in another small town. So through undergrad, I met the guy who I married, and he was on a path to med school. And I was thinking more something international development or something like that. And then someone said, well, you need a skill. You should pick up a skill if you're going to be helpful. So I kind of tagged along to med school. It sounds ridiculous to say it, but it's true. I had done a BA in English Lit and Philosophy, so I hadn't done sciences at all. And so I did them as an extra year after undergrad. I went out to BC and did 4 semesters worth of all the intro. I had actually do math as well, which was kind of a combo of high school equivalent plus enough sciences to be able to write the MCAT. And then I got in because it was a lot easier in those days, thankfully. And then we did couples matched. We did our residency based out of Sudbury, which in those days was still, it was just before NOSM had started. Mm-hmm. There were all med schools, so it was all just residents at that point. So we got tons of good experience, like hands-on with no other learners around kind of thing, for good and bad, but mostly good. And and we just both really loved rural medicine. So we locumed for a while. And then my husband went back to do an extra year of anesthesia. So, and then we just looked on a map and tried to figure out a place that would, where we could both work in sort of a family doctor based town that was close to one set of our parents. And we ended up here in Fergus, Alora, working. And we've been here for just over 15 years now. So I have a small family practice, like a rural family practice, my office. I do obstetrics at our hospital. I do inpatients, although we're phasing into a hospitalist program. And I do like any small town person, you kind of end up doing like palliative care as well and all the stuff that sometimes I see other family doctors listing as their main thing. And I'm like, oh, right, I guess I do that too, whatever. So I don't do eMERGE. I did originally, but I've dropped that. I don't do that anymore. That's basically what I'm up to.
That's what you're up to. I'm curious, when you think about sort of, especially since you've been in practice, have there been times where you found it harder to be in connection with your humanity? Times where maybe you've experienced versions of burnout or burnout light or noticed dropping satisfaction in your job? Has that been a part of your experience in healthcare?
It's a great question. You know, it's funny. I feel like, and I'm going to date myself here for sure. So I graduated in 2000. I was meds 2000, which was like, felt so futuristic at the time. Now it's hilarious. But yeah, we were like, oh my God, we're meds 2000. This is super cool. Just so that you have that perspective. So, you know, burnout wasn't something we talked about in those days. It definitely was completely, I didn't hear burnout talked about as a word in medicine until probably partway through the pandemic, I would say it started to come into, and now I feel like it's, you know, very common, which is great on many levels. It's, so I would never have said that, oh, I'm burnt out and this is why, or the, right? Like you just didn't use that phrasing. I think I've been very lucky in that, you know, we locumed for the first few years and we were in really small towns doing sometimes crazy things and we're a little over our heads clinically, but it was always interesting. The schedule is in our control and we just enjoyed it. Like we just had a lot of fun doing it. And then once I settled into practice here, it's just, we picked really carefully and we found a great town with good balance. And I would, you know, I've gone through phases again, when the kids were little, we're both trying to schedule, like my husband's doing anesthesia, doing eMERGE shifts, I'm doing OB shifts, like the calendar, we're trying to figure out, okay, who actually has the kids for those 3 hours? Cause I feel like nobody does. How are we going to do that? We had selected to be closer to one set of parents so that they could be an option. We used a ton of babysitters, and just kind of pieced it together. So those were, I would say, stressful times just in terms of the juggle. But I'm not sure I ever felt truly burnt out. I think I've been lucky to kind of come through at the time I did, that it's felt pretty manageable most of the time.
That's amazing. I think it speaks to you more than just luck, though. I'll just because I hear that. You know, I think about a lot how people can go through like exactly like carbon copy literal experiences if you look at it from the outside, but depending on their, you could say, mindset or their approach or their sense of how they're viewing themselves in the situation, it can really change their experience of that situation a lot. And that connects me to something that I don't hear physicians say often, but that I loved when I heard you say it, which is when you were describing why you love this hockey team that you're a part of. And you can, I mean, you can say it how you really mean it, but what I remember hearing you say is that like, oh, I love being bad at something. I love just having a space where I can be the worst on the team. Am I getting it right? Is that
yeah,
like, tell me a bit
that's
about
pretty much exactly it. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, I am terrible. So, and you're right. It seems unrelated, but it's probably part of the same attitude. So, this will feel like a tangent, but we'll make it fit. So basically, you know, when I grew up, girls certainly didn't play hockey. We didn't even really have ringette in my area. It didn't exist, I don't think, that I ever heard of. Girls figure skated, that was that. And I tried figure skating and I hated it. It was uncomfortable. I was bad at it. And I didn't love the girls that were doing it, whatever. So, which was basically everybody. So I never did it. And I didn't learn to skate at all. And then the kids started skating when they were little, because that's what you do, right? You take your small children, you throw them at all these crazy sports and assume that they're going to figure it out. And I was like, and they all got quite good at it, oddly. And my husband skated, and So it kind of, I don't know, it just, I decided that I was going to learn to skate. So I actually, the arena really close to us has adult learn to skate lessons, which I did, which was among the most terrifying moments I've had in my life. Like, I remember letting go of the board that first time and just being like, what is even happening? This is crazy. I had skated before that, but always with a stroller when the kids were little. So the big thing was, once they didn't want to be in a stroller anymore, they were actually the youngest. My youngest was actually wanting to skate himself. And I'm like, well, now I can't go with you anymore because I don't have a stroller. So I did it, and I actually got better at it, shockingly. Who knew? You don't just have to be instantly good thing. You can take lessons just like, you know, medical school. Who knew? And so I did that. And then my girls by then were starting to play hockey. We had this advice from a cousin whose girls were in hockey, saying it's a good sport for girls. Like, and I kind of had looked at our girls who were very close together. They're only a year apart, 15 months apart. At that time, they just had different skill sets. They were different physical builds. And we thought, you know, hockey might not be a crazy idea. Like, let's try it. And we had an arena close to us. So they were actually starting to play hockey. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. And so I just started. So I took, I did beginner hockey that was kind of controlled. Like, it was called 3-on-3 in a smaller rink. And then I signed up for this league, and it's just the best thing. And I love it for so many reasons, but you're right. One of the main reasons is that I am terrible. And I know that I've always been the weakest person on our team. The teams are sorted by, you know, how good you are. So sometimes I'll spot my equivalent on another team, you know, and be like, we never actually talk. That would be weird, but yeah, I can pick them out. But on my own team, I'm always I'm the bottom of the barrel. But you know, in hockey, and I remember very clearly, I think I had told you this probably in my third year, someone was, I think I was like, yeah, I'm really bad. I'm sorry, after particularly, you know, terrible shift. And she was like, you know what? It's just great. You come out and, like, you know, we just bodies, like the bad players give us good players a chance to rest. Cause we have to kind of, I was like, I think that's a compliment. But taking it, like, if I can provide you a rest, that is awesome. Like, that is what I'm here to do. And I think that when I've asked other people, friends, to join, or, you know, you should think about it, it's so interesting because I often get a very negative response, right? People are like, oh, well, you know, I can't skate. Okay. And I tell them my story, and, or, well, I've never done it before, or I would be terrible, or, you know, I just can't. Like, it's really interesting that it's often, I think, something that you just can't even think about doing because you assume you need sort of a base level to do it or something. And I feel bad for them because they're missing out on this sort of concept of not being very good at something. And it's actually super relaxing. And if I happen to do something great, that's amazing. Like, that carries me for weeks. You know, I remember once I scored a goal last season and it was like, oh my God, the NHL next. Like, oh my God, I'm amazing at this. And then the other pieces that I'll watch, the, you know, because we have some amazing women, like, they are such strong players. And yet they have this amazing shift, and they almost score, and they've done like five things that I you know, just blow me away. They come off and they're like, oh God, I can't believe I missed that goal. Like, they're upset with themselves. They don't realize how high up they are. And I find that very useful too, because it's like, oh, interesting. We're all so hard on ourselves, and very, you know, like, even when you're at this level, you're still feeling like, I should have tried harder. I could have done better, which is great because that helps you improve. But it's also interesting to see that. Yeah, I find that really, really fascinating to watch.
Yeah. I, like, really, after you shared that experience, and then I thought about how you are, like, a rural family physician, and you describe the varying things you do, and, you know, in various group chats are a part of, you're describing the wilds and the Wild West of what can happen in rural hospitals, and probably hospitals everywhere these days, unfortunately, with, like, scant resources and all these things. And I've found myself wondering, like, do you not have any perfectionism? Or is that it? I'm like, how is Sarah the way she is? I want to understand, like, whether you call it perfectionism or whatever, but I know, like, for myself, like, I'm trying to actively shed my fear of being bad at things, but, like, I get like an intense shame response, anxiety response about being bad, and especially team sports. Like, I'm the one like I kind of barely played soccer, and I did it for intramurals because we had to do some activity, and I mostly would try and just not be near the ball as much as possible. And then like other group sport settings, like there would be times where I would just leave and cry in the bathroom because no one else would even know or care. I wasn't in a, I'm just a body mentality.
I'm just a shift. You know, I'm like a pylon. Like if I can just get in someone else's way, that's awful. I know. It's bad. Well, and you know, as a kid, I was not a sporty kid. Like, let's be clear. Again, in my small town, you were smart or you were sporty. And I was on the smart side, and that was that. There's very little crossover even in high school. And so, you know, I was a band and I was like student council, but I was definitely not sporty. And no, I did nothing, like literally nothing through high school. I played volleyball briefly and that was that. It was, so it really, I've only become more active as an adult. So I don't know why I agree. I think there is something to that. And when I see learners coming through, you know, in rural medicine, you do have to have this, or even in family medicine in general, for sure. But then in rural family medicine, it's even probably on steroids, that you just have to be comfortable with the fact that you definitely don't know everything. I'm still seeing new things. Like, you know, I've been doing this for 23 years and I still get new stuff. And I'm confident that the last day I ever see a patient, they'll come in with something new that I've never seen before. You know, it just keeps happening. And you just have to have this kind of general approach, right? And this sort of confidence that to just be human with them, actually, which is your theme, and just say, okay, you know, I don't know what this is. We're going to figure it out, but I don't think it's something that's going to be a disaster in the next 12 hours. And let's figure it out. And this is my path to trying to figure it out. And patients are very good with that when in our experience. Now, again, I wonder if rural patients are a little bit different than some of the urban patients I hear about. But then, I don't know, some days I think, no, I definitely do have patients that are, you know, different. They're just a bit more anxious about things. They tend to look things up. They've had very often, it comes from experiences in the past where they haven't been taken seriously, or things have gone awry when they did trust somebody, whether that was in a health system or something else. And you just have to kind of meet them where they're at, you know, and figure that out and be comfortable that, yeah, I totally actually really don't know what to do with this, but I'm going to figure it out. And here's our next plan. And the joy of family medicine is you can just keep bringing them back, right? It's never a one-off thing. You can, okay, we're going to try this. I actually don't think this is going to work, but let's try it and then come back next week. And by then I'll have had some time to look around, ask a friend, do a consult, you know, and come up with a plan. So I think that comfort has to be there, or you just drive yourself crazy. Like you can't sustain that level of like having to know every single thing. You would burn out, actually. You would collapse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You see that, like in certain learners as they come through, or even people who do make it through and are in practice, but especially early practice, like I think that the need both internally to feel like you're on top of everything, and but then that definition of what on top of is like superhuman, but not having that. And also for me, a thing I've really had to grapple with is like the need for everyone to perceive me as always a really good doctor, which means I know everything. Like there's sort of twisted beliefs in there where like if I don't know the answer, that means that they're going to think I'm a bad doctor and they're going to put something on Rate MD, or they're going to sue me, or there's like this fear of, you know, colleagues' opinions of me, fear of patients' opinions of me. And I think that can really get in the way. Is that something like, do you get haunted by such things, or like, and if not, how do you do that?
So no, I don't know. I don't know, Joe. It's not something that has haunted me, for sure. I would say that. I think, you know, I came through med school feeling pretty dumb a lot of the time, to be honest, because I hadn't done those sciences. I mean, I had classmates, God bless them, who had done full life science degrees or health science. I don't even know what they had done. Like it didn't even make sense to me. And I had done English and philosophy. So I had to work so hard through med school. I didn't understand half of what we were doing, honestly, but I figured it out. And when we got to the third year with the people part, I was like, oh, I can do this. This is fine. Like, give me people to talk to. And so I think that is maybe was actually very helpful, because I knew from an early stage that I was never going to be that, you know, oh, well, I can't name 12 differentials for anything, right? And I'm much better, like with experience, I've learned a ton, and I can feel that I just have a much broader differential for things without having to go and look it up. But I just had to look stuff up constantly. And I did that, and it worked. And as long as you actually spoke to people and made them feel like you were going to do that and explained it with confidence, and listen to their stories, right? Because it's not really usually about the rash. And even if they really want to know what it is and you're really not sure, if they feel like you're taking them seriously and you understand that, you know what, person A, they just kind of want it gone. They just want the itch gone. They're not super whatever. They're okay with it. Person B, this is keeping them up at night. Like, what the hell is this? It's not even that itchy. It's just bugging them that it's there. And you have to treat those two rashes very differently, even though they might actually be the exact same rash. But what you're going to say to that person, how you're going to treat them, what you might do to investigate it, it is actually different between those people. A rash is kind of a strange example, but I would take that to anything. Even though you know in your head it's the outcome is going to be the same and so on. And I think that's the key, is actually seeing the person. And that I never struggled with. That I found very easy. That came naturally. And so the medicine part of it, I'd be like, I just have to look up what I'm going to give you, because I don't remember. Is it an ointment? Is it the 0.5 or the 0.05? And I still struggle sometimes with that, although it's much better now. But in terms of like, oh, you're a person where I can just say, you know what, I'm not really sure, but let's try this cream and it's probably going to work and they're going to go home, versus the person where they're like, you know, is okay. And finally you realize that, oh, their grandma started with a rash like this, and then she had a heart attack the next day. And that's why they're worried about it. Right. Which, you know, once you figure that out, then you're going to fix that per person, and you're still going to give them the exact same cream, but it's a very different situation. Yeah. I don't know if that answered your question, but
it fully did in multiple ways. I think in terms of like that, because like the perfectionism piece, it's just I don't even know if that is the right word, but like it's a more specific phenomena in medicine, I think. And my hypothesis that you're like kind of confirming is like, if we get sort of, if our brains get overemphasized about knowledge acquisition and research and titles and thinking we need to memorize all the details, like we have to be good at medicine trivia, if you will, like, you know, and like, it's about having all the knowledge in your brain. And that's the most and kind of most important thing. And even then how you get trained clinically, the most important thing out of that clinical encounter is, what is the diagnosis? Obviously that is an important piece. Like, let's be clear. That's an important piece.
For sure. I'm not, you know, like I also like to diagnose things. I'm not useful, a total slacker.
Like, you're having a heart attack and then, like, your leg's broken. Like, that's not helping anybody.
Yeah. No. I'm good at that stuff. Don't worry.
Yeah, I bet you crush that every time, Sarah. But there's like an and piece of like, especially off, like a class, I am a life science kid. And like, you get so overemphasized about that knowledge and excellence and academics and competition versus like the people part. I think it absolutely served you that you did a non-science based undergrad and that wasn't your mindset going in. Like and that you therefore you did exactly as much as you needed to, which is all any of us have to do.
Yes.
You know, and not getting like an A++. You don't even get grades in most medical schools. There were no grades.
No, thank goodness. We were pass fail, and thank God, because I remember, and I did fail one thing. It was we had this histology bell ringer in first year. And, you know, again, like I laugh at it now, but that was stressful. That was a time where I was like, holy shit. First of all, I've never looked under a microscope before because I hadn't done any microscopy. I don't know, somehow in those first year sciences I did, I mean, we must have done some microscope work, but not very much. Like, it really didn't seem to come up. And so even for me, just walking into that room and having to look into a microscope and figure out how to actually see, and now I use microscopes a lot for in OB, so I'm very confident at it. But every time I approach it, I remember that day of like, how no one's taught me how to do this. Like, I've literally never Because for some reason, our histology classes were all slides, like they were on the screen, but we actually had to look in anyway. And then the concept of a bell ringer, which I actually didn't understand what it was until I walked in that room. And I was like, we can't go back. Because my approach to exams, which I realized only that day, was, you go through, you figure out what you can do, you write some answers, and then you make some little notes, and then you go back and you kind of expand. And this was not that. And I absolutely crashed and burned, and I failed that bell ringer for sure. I know, like, I actually got an F on it. And I just had to laugh, because when I talked to classmates, they had literally, you know, the life sci kids had actually done that, almost that exact same exam, you know, a year or two ago. And so they thought it was one of the easiest things we had to do. And I'm just like, is this hell? Like, oh, there's like an arm with a pin in it, and I'm supposed to, and I only have 30 seconds. It's literally a bell that rings and you must. Like, this just, it blew my mind that this even existed. So that's a great example of where I was like, and then I remember asking somebody, like, are we gonna have to keep doing that? And they were like, no, it's just a one-off. It's just this one prof that thinks that's a good way, and we will never have to do this again. Thank goodness. And I mean, I had the OSCE stations are similar. Once there are actually bell ringers, once you get that far, whatever they're calling them now, the MMI type stations, but you know, by then we had practiced they're like 10 minutes or whatever they were. It was a very, very different scenario. It wasn't just 30 seconds. And also looking around the room, and all my classmates are just calmly writing things. And I was just like, I'm sure I passed about 5 stations before I even wrote anything down. Like, it was terrifying. Oh man. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. And I mean, it just makes sense, right? It's not like, even like, because we get kind of, I relate to the experience of getting conditioned to be good at tests.
Mm-hmm.
And so that does get you a certain amount of a way. And the interesting thing, yeah, though, with medical school, which often you have to have done many, many tests to get in, at a certain point, it breaks down a little bit if the main thing that you're conditioned to do is be good at taking tests, because like they're, you know, multiple choice. The patient in front of you, multiples of those choices you could choose.
Yes.
And
yes,
if you're like, oh, but which one? And you could be thinking,
yeah,
these rashes, like the rash example, I love that. Like, you could think you've gotten the answer. Oh, the answer is A, it's eczema. And then the patient's like, no. And you're like, what? No, I got,
no, <it I'm>, is.
I got my A. Why are you arguing with me? And it's because, yes, there's the whole people part. Like, it's like, it sounds like, I mean, a huge skill set. I hope you give yourself credit for it, because I think it is so essential, and we need to like really magnify it in medical education, and probably like all education, is like being good with people, being an expert at people and connecting with them, and how that is not just like, oh, those are the nice doctors with the good bedside manner, but that's like an incredibly important part of what we're doing here.
Yeah, it's a real skill. And I think you get a lot of practice in something, or you, if you choose to, you can get a lot of practice in something like that with obstetrics, because, you know, that's a great time where they can't just come back. Like, I can't just be like, oh, this isn't really working for me today. Why don't you just pause your labor and come back in a week and we'll see where we're at. You know, it's very, you're in and you're on. And the way our model works is that which I think is becoming more and more common, is I often haven't met these women, or I've only met them for a few times before, because we share care and we're a hard call, et cetera. So, which has many, many advantages. And a few disadvantages, and people will say to me, well, how do you find that? Because you haven't even met these people when they come in labor, you know, you may not even know them. But I think it gives you this really amazing skill set, if you choose to embrace it, of, okay, I'm in the room, and what's the deal? What's going on here? Who are you? Who are they? Who's with you? What's your expectation here? And it's that whole, and you have to take that into account in labor. You cannot just be like, oh, your strip is excellent and you appear to be coping well. See ya in 3 hours. Like, it really doesn't work like that, right? There's actually very little medicine in normal labor. Interestingly, I mean, there is, and I'm not, but I don't mean to diminish normal labor. It's hugely complex. Don't get me wrong, now that I just said that, but it's a lot about inserting yourself into that room and just what's the vibe, what's going on, how are things going, are they getting along, are we, you know, and that's really, and it actually can make or break their labors in terms of, I really believe that after all these years, that if things are off, either it's because the labor's not progressing well and everyone's picking up on that, or it actually will change the labor. Like it affects how well things are going. And then, and not, and also there's that piece to it, but it's also just being kind. So I've, you know, we have a lot of Mennonite patients in our area, and a Mennonite labor, a person who, a family who is in labor, who is a Mennonite patient, it can be a very different experience from, and I've had this experience where back across the room from each other, you know, I remember very clearly I had a very traditional, lovely Mennonite family who she was on her fifth baby. Things were going very calm, very quiet. And then across, literally across the hall, was a very loud family, first baby, lots of coming and going, lots going on, like very hyper excited. And they both were having a wonderful experience in their own way. But for me, moving from room to room, I have to match the vibe in each room. And so it's almost like you have to sort of, okay, I'm going into the calm room. So let's go into the calm room. The lights are down. I'm talking very, you know, everything's great. I'm not in for long. I'm really keeping myself, you know, I'm not needing to insert myself into their situation. The loud family, the lights are on, there's music, everyone's asking me questions, like I'm right in there, you know, and you're literally moving yourself back and forth in the space of 20 minutes. And so it's kind of cool because it forces you to really realize that's such an important part of everything that we do.
Matching the vibes. I think let's have a bell ringer about matching vibes, honestly. I think
Oh, that's a great idea. That I would
would
love.
love to be part of that
You
actually.
have 5 minutes
Or
to make this person feel like you actually know what they're talking. You
I
you care about them, you know?
like actually I think that's we pro at least equal to the other kinds of bell ringers we have to do, because it is a learned skill. And even I mean you could be I forget if it's sociopaths or psychopaths, the ones that have no emotions themselves. Anyway, but you could kind of learn those. It'd be harder for them, but you could, actors have to learn those skills. You know what I mean? These are skills. These are skills. These are skills that are
No, and
practiced and
it's, there's a
learned.
lot to it. Like it is about, you know, maybe you do need to ask some questions, very direct questions, and other times you kind of don't. And then you also have to think about, and again, to go back to the Mennonite example, like there are a lot of types of Mennonites, and some Mennonite rooms are very different than other Mennonite rooms. So you can't assume that you're walking into the exact same scenario just because of that, right? Insert any racial or cultural norm. Like it's just, you really have to, you maybe ask direct questions, or maybe not, and that's okay too. So yeah, it's there's a lot of skill there, and then it come back to, I think it then it gives me that, okay, well, I just have to figure this out, and now I'm figuring out hockey. Like what's going on here? How do I fit into this game without feeling like I'm totally useless, or you know, I'm bad. How do I, yeah, like they're not gonna get mad at me or make not let me go again, or something like that, or kick me off the team. And but it's just, it's also just for fun. Like this should be a time of joy and play. And I, when I hear people say, oh, I couldn't, I'm just not good enough, you know, and I'm like, oh, interesting. So what are you doing for fun? Like, because you can't be good at everything. Like you can't, you know, and when I'm terrible on the ice, I can think of, and I can think, you know, like this woman next to me, what's her job? Like she is maybe in a, you know, and I know, and some of them are maybe working at a retail store, you know, or doing a lot of night shifts or things that where they don't have a lot of control over their lives and maybe don't have this as a big financial investment for them, et cetera. And so let them be the best. Like that's awesome if they are. You know, because I got satisfaction in many other areas of my life. I have control over my whole life, basically. And so give that gift to somebody else of letting them be better than you, of asking them for advice in a scenario where normally they might be the one asking me for advice. Like, isn't that cool that they're actually giving me tips, you know? So, and I've told a lot of my patients, I mean, it's a rural area, right? So we'll start talking about hockey, or you know, they've got a little like the Leafs hat on or something, and I'll share that I've been trying to play hockey, and they just love it. Like you can see their eyes just light up, and they're like, "Oh, how's it going?" And I used to be a D back in my day, and blah blah. We start talking about that, and again, it just it gives you that insight, and it lets them see that okay, and I am terrible. Like I am an excellent doctor, I am a terrible right winger, and they just love that, right? That there's something that they know that they're so much better than me at. So it's good that way too. I think it's it adds to your humanity, right? To be a bit more rounded maybe.
Yeah. It makes work more fun too, to be connected in that way, right? Like bringing for sure. humanity in.
Yeah.
I have a question it feels connected to me, especially when you brought up obstetrics. I know for me the reason I cut myself off from even really considering it too much is I had fear of bad outcomes. Obviously bad outcomes can happen anywhere, but it feels higher stakes there. And I mean, it is in some ways, short term, you know. I'm curious whether it's connected to this other stuff we've been talking about or not. Like, how do you cope, manage, mitigate? Like, how do you kind of in your mind think of undesired outcomes, is usually the way I put it. So it's, but like whether it's a truly like a really undesired outcome for a patient, or it's even lawsuit complaint where like, you know, like those sorts of elements. I'm imagining, I mean, we know medical legally OB is one of the things you have to pay the highest CMPA fees, don't you? Or one of the like,
yes we do. Especially actual obstetrics. I don't mean to undermine, but yeah, FMOBs are, we're right up there. We're up there with the eMERGE. Like we pay the same as the eMERGE guys do. In Ontario anyway, we pay the same as the eMERGE docs do. Excuse me. No, for sure. And I think, you know, again, legally, I've never actually, I just can't control that. Like if someone's going to sue me, they're going to sue me. And I, in my experience over the years, and again, when I graduated, we weren't this stressed about getting sued. I'll say that. And I feel very blessed to have graduated in a time when it just like CMPA existed and we all paid it. But like to actually call CMPA for advice was, I don't think I ever knew anyone who even really talked about that until probably 5 or 10 years ago at the most. Like, so I feel blessed to have graduated. It was something Americans did, right? It wasn't something that Canadians did. It just wasn't really a concept. And I'm sure there were lots of lawsuits going on, but it wasn't like, I don't even think we had a talk in med school from CMPA, for example. I think maybe in residency, somebody showed up once and talked about communication, like the 5 C's, right? But it there wasn't what I'm sensing now from our learners, which is this very check CMPA, oh, call CMPA for that, call CMPA for that, check first, don't move until you call them first. So I feel very lucky to have graduated at that time, because I do think that's changed a lot, and I don't envy you guys at all. See, I'm including you as a new grad.
Thank you.
You see that? Like I did that there? Yeah. Okay, so that's one thing. And I think that's carried with me that I really, at this point, I was just joking with somebody yesterday. I'm like, you know what? If I get a big lawsuit, I'm just going to retire. Like, it's cool. If you want to take my license at this point, it's fine. Like, I will. And there's things that I'll go to the mat for. Like, if someone's going to take away my license because I used an LU code illegally, awesome. I will fight you for that. Like, I will go to the stand for that freaking LU code because I hate them or whatever it is. Like, there are things that I will, if that takes me down, I'm good. But I think the more important part is for me is dealing personally with errors or with mistakes. And I think I think obstetrics, again, like it's good because you realize how little is in your control, right? And at the same time, you're always prepared for the worst. And I think especially in rural OB, we just have to, because we don't have, you know, as much of the resources as someone else does. There's certain things that we actually need to move someone out of the building to deal with. And so you learn that as your strategy, how to anticipate problems and head them off before they happen. And that's really what OB is all about. And then when bad things do happen, I think I've always recognized that someone needs to be there. So, you know, baby dies, a woman comes in and there's no heartbeat, or patient comes in, there's no heartbeat, you know, at any stage, but especially at term is when we'll, you know, like a term stillbirth, or there was a heartbeat during labor, now we've lost it. Baby comes out very, very flat unexpectedly and is needing a ton of recess and maybe doesn't survive that recess. We're doing that all. We don't have pediatricians. We don't have, like, there's no one else to help us with baby. We have obstetricians who will help us with mom, but the baby is all on us, and we can call for transfer, but we definitely, there's a waiting period for that. We're usually responsible for at least that first hour, I would say, before a transport team gets to us. We maybe have an RT if it's 9 to 4, but after hours, it's really just us. And you get your skills up as much as you can, and you get your algorithms and you figure it out. And then you just have to be grateful that someone is there, and that someone is me who is can handle this. And this is really not about me. It's about the family and the baby and the patient. And I will later will process this and take this on and go through it, and could we have done anything differently? And shit, like, what the hell happened here? But at the time, you really have to decenter yourself and really make sure that it's about them, and that thank goodness someone is in this room who has the experience and the presence to manage the situation, because at least I'm trained on how to manage it. Whereas for this family, they have never gone through this before. They have no idea what's happening. They're never, hopefully, gonna know anyone that this has happened to before. And it's up to me to manage their experience and make sure that even on this worst day, that they're still able to have the best experience out of that. And I think that's really what you start to realize, that, okay, this isn't, I mean, for sure, we have to recognize the abnormal fetal hearts and act on them and try to prevent stillbirths and do all the prenatal care, but crap just happens sometimes, and that's very shocking for people. And so you just kind of have to get to a point where you're comfortable being the person that manages that and walks them through it.
It strikes me, like you said a couple times in what we've been talking about, that you know what's under your control and what's not. Like you, including you were like, I'm in control of most things in my life. Like, you were saying in context of like your work and that you have a lot of agency, and you
Scheduling and
also
all that
know.
stuff. Yeah.
And within that, you totally recognize what is out of your control. And I
Yeah.
think when we conflate those, it's a lot of the kind of confusion and pain and suffering that I used to experience, and sometimes definitely still do, and like others I see, like whether it's learners or colleagues or whatever, they don't recognize what they do have agency to change. And they think that it, like, if an outcome like a death, an untimely death happens, then they internalize it as if they could have controlled it.
For sure.
Did you always know which part of life was under your control? I know it's a strange question, but I am curious. Like, was it kind of learning along the way, or, early on, like early cases, or how did
Yeah,
you
it's a good
figure that out?
question. It's a good question. I mean, as you probably know, we ex ourselves experienced not a stillbirth, but we our oldest got cancer, leukemia, when he was 11 months, and died when he was 18 months. And that, I think was very that taught us a lot, right? About there's just a shitload of stuff that is not in your control, and that's okay. Like, you can do everything you can and do all the right things. I mean, we were vegetarian, we raised him well, we did everything we could, and stuff still happens. And I don't know if it was after that that I kind of realized that that was sort of, but I think it gave me that, like, oh, okay, well, as much as you think, even as a parent, that you can control things, can't, it's just gonna happen. And so I think so much of medicine is like that, that you're right. We're trained that, okay, if you just keep the cholesterol to this number and the blood pressure to this number, everything's going to be great. And the problem is that those things are true, but they're true on a population level. And when I've got the person in front of me, I have no idea. This person could have perfect blood pressure and blow out their aortic valve tomorrow or whatever, maybe not, or they could walk in front of a bus, or they could, crazy things happen. They could have a massive brain tumor that I miss, or they miss, or who knows, right? Life is very short, and we have a lot less control about what goes on than I think we're trained to think we have. And especially with social media in the last sort of 5, 10 years. Again, I grew up as a doctor in a time before social media. And so there weren't people telling me every day, you know, if you eat a gram of protein per kilogram, you'll stop your menopause or whatever I'm supposed to be doing, right?
It's like, it is wild. Okay.
But, you know, when you see that 10 times in a morning, you're like, maybe you're right. And you start calculating, how much protein am I eating? I don't know. And shit, am I too far behind now? Like, how am I going to do this? And it kind of eats away at you, right?
Yes.
Whereas I think you when you're in this job, you see that the people who are the very healthiest still go down. And the people who are crazy lifestyle people, they survive through sometimes and not always. And I don't mean to overstate that. Obviously, everyone needs to make good choices. But, you know, there's a lot that is not in our control. And I think we're really fooling ourselves as physicians if we actually think that that stuff, the vast majority of stuff, is not in our control. It's how wealthy people are. It's, do they have a roof over their heads? It's, do they have good relationships with the people around them? Do they have job satisfaction? Like, these are the things that actually determine how you're going to go day to day, right? Yeah. And if I can't change those things. I can help. I can write my letters and, you know, do stuff. And I do that. But really, whether their cholesterol is 5 or 7, you know, once they're over 80, why am I even caring? And even then, do you know what I mean? Like, it's just all these little things that really, I definitely will pay attention to them, and I don't skip them, but I can't worry about them either. As well as whether patients take my excellent advice. That's another area where I see young doctors getting very stressed, is when they're like, I don't understand. Like, I told them all this stuff and it's so, and then they just don't do it. Like, what is up? Should I fire them because they're not listening to me? And I'm like,
what? You won't have any patients left.
To me, like, just, and I remember during the pandemic, this really came out, right? When people are like, you know, non-medical people, my friends were like, I can't believe people aren't getting vaccinated. Like, they're just not listening to you. And I'm like, no nonsense to me. Like, I'm not their moms. Even my kids don't necessarily. Like, I'm here to provide advice. And, you know, if you come to me with specific questions, I will give you as good as information as I possibly can. But, you know, if you don't take my excellent advice, that's on you. That's not my problem. And so, yeah. And I think a lot of the younger doctors really take that personally and really worry about that, oh, well, and they're documenting, you know, okay, well, if I just document that he refused the Lipitor, even though his cholesterol was this, and I showed him the graph and blah, 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 then I guess I won't get sued. And it's like, well, that person is never going to sue you. Like, that is not, no one's suing you because they chose not to take Lipitor, because, you know what I mean? Like, it's just not, and I it's so sad to me. Like, I don't know where that pathway has come from, but it's very destructive. It's really hard for, I think, so for some of the young grads. Yeah. It's rough. It's really rough.
I feel that. I have a question that, like all these questions, you can say yes or no to. And I think it's not to get deep into it. My main wondering is, so after that time where you lost your child, how did that impact, like, how did you come back to work? Or you know what I mean? Like, just the, we don't need to dive deep into that, because I imagine that's very
no for sure. And as you also probably know, like, I there's a group on Facebook that I moderate, which is specifically around bereaved doctor moms. So it's moms who have lost children who are also physicians. It's very specific. However, there are actually over 100 of us right now, and this is just a Canadian group. And it's summer, there's quite a percent of, like, late pregnancy or stillbirths, but there's a solid number of teenagers and small children like mine, adults as well, who maybe have died from suicide or an accident, stuff like that, so, or illnesses. So there's quite a few of us. So that's a big topic that's discussed. And yeah, it sucks. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we've had women who had stillbirths who then come back to labor and delivery and have to deal with a stillbirth right away. We have women who did CPR on their own child and then find themselves doing CPR on another child 6 months later, or at an ACLS course where they're having to practice doing CPR. And, you know, it's not easy, but I think with support of others, with just kind of an understanding that, okay, this is really hard and maybe I can't do it. And some have moved on or switched areas or figured it out. But I think most of us have managed to just kind of amalgamate's the wrong word, but just sort of folded in, you know, that, okay, well, I guess this is how it's going to be now. And you know what? Like these people in front of me, these patients, they've had terrible things happen to them too. Like I'm not special. This is actually normal. This is normal. This is the human experience, is having these really crazy, unexpected things happen, whether it's a parent dying too soon or a terrible illness yourself. I mean, we have physicians, colleagues with, you know, who are managing brain tumors and cancers and all kinds of stuff. And you, on the one point, you, there was always a point for every human thought, oh, this will never happen to me. And then it does. And you just have to figure it out and move through it. So I think that, you know, the classic, stereotype is, oh, it gives you such a better understanding of others. And I would hope that's not true, in a sense that I hope you don't have to go through something like that to get a better understanding of others. But I do think there is some truth in that too, that you're not afraid. You're not afraid anymore to ask the hard questions. Like when I see the, you know, the stillbirth on a previous chart or something, I'll just ask them directly about it. Whereas I think some other colleagues might be like, oh, I don't want to go there in case, you know, or whatever. And little things like that, that I definitely will kind of get in there and get them talking about it in a way that maybe others aren't quite as comfortable with.
I also hope, like, I think we don't all have to sign up to have every single horrible thing happen to each of us, because that just doesn't, I mean,
No,
that's just tricky. I can't. But hopefully, I'm like, I appreciate you sharing your experience. I think some when we hear at least other people experiencing the same thing, that can give us some wisdom, even if we haven't lived it ourselves, for sure. So thank
for
you.
sure. Which is why that month group is there, because it's a terrible moment. And I think it's you know, it is there are specific things about being a physician and going through the death of your child that is, it's hard for to just go to a regular bereaved month group sometimes and kind of get that, because you're literally like, well, I was reading his blood results and maybe I should have picked up that the weight count had dropped to less than one before, you know. And regular moms maybe aren't at that long.
They're not
So
analyzing.
yeah, exactly. So it is very helpful. And then that concept of, like, so many of us happen to come from family medicine or eMERGE or obstetrics, or areas where we are literally every day going in to potentially face similar situations to what we personally went through, that it is a very, I think, specific type of experience that's super helpful to share with others who've been through it.
I know. I can't remember if you were the one that told me about it, but like when my husband had cancer last year, and yeah, I was then I joined the physician. I think they all were physician moms with a loved one going through cancer. That was it was a slightly shorter name, but it actually was shorter.
No,
And
it's pretty long.
it's pretty long. And it was like the thing that everyone says is like, "Sorry, sorry, you're in here." And we've got you, but you know what I mean, like that. And there was something very healing about just having a connection to people who had different, like, were going through different, even different things, but like having a space where it was just like permission to talk about it in a medical type way still.
Yes, because
So,
sometimes you just need that. Like, people will be like, okay, this is my autopsy report, like, what do you guys think, or something, you know. And we're all up for that. Like, we are happy to read through your baby's autopsy report and help you analyze that, you know. And that's not something that you can always find in a space, even though that's maybe what you need that day or whatever it is. So yeah,
That's
definitely.
beautiful. Well, I knew I was gonna want to talk to you for 50 billion hours, and so I'm glad that we're friends, and we can have
We
many other
didn't even get to
chats,
anything
but
parenting. God.
I know. Well, I feel like even just like you said, that was great advice at the beginning of like be friends with parents at different ages. I didn't do that on purpose, but I definitely that is like some of my favorite friends are people who are parents of like teenagers and stuff. I just love being like, oh, look at you go. And then like hear your advice. It's so
But start to collect the younger ones too,
I
because you
know
realize
that.
it's just like teaching med students in a way. Like, you realize, and it gives you that, oh, I've really come a long way. Like, I actually know what I'm talking about now, which is very helpful. Like, it really, yeah. And then also, it's just like, oh my God, thank goodness I'm not doing that anymore. No
I feel
offense.
that
I love
even
my
like
babies,
when
but
there's
whole, yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot.
when
No.
people are like, I love the baby phase the most, I just like, I don't think there's anything wrong with them either, but I cannot relate. I just
No,
cannot relate.
I definitely, that was
Thank
not
you.
my favorite. That
Oof,
was not my
I
time to
like
shine.
sleeping. I like my own time.
Yeah, I like them being able to walk places. That's nice. I like
Oh,
that.
so great. We're at the skipping nap stage, and it's like the
Nice.
world's your oyster. You don't
Oh,
have to plan around a nap.
no. Yeah, so you can actually do stuff. Yes,
Yes, it's just like free
oh,
nap.
that's
So
so
good.
good. Yeah.
Well, actually, I have two questions left for you. So one is a question I've been asking more on this podcast than I was in the past, but I am aware that you're familiar with the works of Taylor Allison Swift and have been
Yes.
to an Eras Tour one,
Yes,
right?
I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, one.
So what's your favorite era? What's your favorite thing about Taylor? What do you want to share about why you love Taylor Swift?
About Taylor Swift. Well, it's been an interesting journey for me, I would say, because I, and so this actually, here we go with the parenting. So for me, I was like, okay, what the hell, teenagers? Wow, you seem really interested in Taylor Swift. I'm going to go there too. So I kind of entered it with them. So I have two girls who are now 18 and 17, but, and then my younger boy is 14, but, it was truly because of them and just trying to like listen to their music and follow along with what they were up to. And then they got tickets to Detroit very early. We were in that like first, like they had tickets within 10 minutes of the very before it all blew up. Like I know it was crazy. Like they even got six tickets. At that time you could get six tickets, which is
Didn't
crazy now to
Ticketmaster
think
shut
about it.
down after that or
I
something,
know
right? Like
it
it was bad.
totally, it exploded about 20 minutes in, but we were in that first 10 minutes. We even got a cap that day. It was crazy. I remember it very clearly. And so that as they, and that was in like months and months and months. And then the tour actually started and they were, one of them especially was like watching it live and really into it. And I started kind of getting more into it. And then as they had their tickets doled out for their kids. And I had said, I will drive you to Detroit. It's about 3 hours and I will pay for a hotel room. That's my contribution to the situation. You pay for your tickets, you pay for everything else, whatever. And so then I was like, no, I'm going to be there anyway. Blah, blah, blah. So I bought my own ticket. About It was very close beforehand. It was about a month beforehand. Again, at that time, tickets were, even the StubHub tickets were quite reasonable compared to anything they are now. And I just went and I was on my own and I was high up and I could see them, but I wasn't interfering with them at all. And it was just super cool. And that experience was, yeah, it was just really special. So I don't know that I don't necessarily think of her in terms of, oh, this one song really speaks to me or this is my era. I don't quite have that. It's more of like, I'm relating to her because this is a real bond moment with my girls and their friends. And we got to take them and stay over in this hotel. And it was just a really cool experience, that whole parenting of like, and very, you can make all write all kinds of symbolism into it too, right? That they're down there enjoying it with their friends and I'm kind of over them observing them and but also enjoying my own time and in a space that I probably would have made fun of 5 years ago, right? Like I remember saying to them, I'm like, I was non-ironically at that concert. Like I was right there. I was into it. This is not a, oh my God.
It was an incredible, I remember like right after being like, that
Yes.
was like such
Oh,
a beautiful experience.
it
And that I
really
was like,
was.
ooh, like I got into it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And I believe I am responsible for you that then getting your ticket
That's
partly, or at
right. Because
least
I was like,
I
oh,
was
I was getting like
definitely.
obsessed with her.
Yeah.
And then you're
Yeah.
like, put aside the money, just
Just
do
get the
it.
damn ticket, like
And
50
I'm
bucks a
like,
month. You've
okay.
got 10 months. It's all good or whatever it is. Like, just do it. Yeah. No, 100%. I fully, and I think it's great. I love that you're not, oh, I should take my boys. 'Cause it's a big and maybe they're not, but if you had slightly older girls, or something like that,
Right.
like you might be like, oh, I should, 'cause I see a lot of people like, well, I can't just go myself. I have to get like three tickets for these little kids of mine or whatever. And I'm like, just go yourself. Like they, they're like 10 years old. They're not going to appreciate it. I don't know. I'm very like,
No.
maybe I'm a little too hard line, but I just, it is really a special experience. You're gonna really like it. Yeah, it's quite
Yes.
amazing. Yeah.
I don't want to
Yeah.
be socially hindered by anyone else. I want to have my religious
Exactly. Just
experience.
your own space and your goals. Yeah,
And I'm high up. I'm one of the
100%.
500. I'm gonna be like,
Oh, high
no,
is
tiny
great
little.
though, because
I'm
you can
excited to see the
see the
whole thing.
stage. Yeah,
And the
my girls
lights
were
and the
lower
lights.
and they couldn't actually see the top of the stage. They didn't realize what was going on. Again, this was early days, so not everyone had seen all the clips yet, and they weren't,
Right.
They could, one of them had avoided social media completely. She actually had no idea what was coming. Yeah, which was kind of amazing, actually. The other one was, you know, fully immersed. But yeah, and she didn't realize there was stuff on the stage until I started showing her my pictures, because she couldn't see it from where they were. So yeah, so I'm very biased towards high up. I think it's great. Yep.
Excellent.
Yep.
I love that. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And then the last question I often ask people to share is like, so picturing like people who listen to the podcast, like all different stages of their career in healthcare, including like medical students and learners, and then people closer to retirement or retired. And I also have like some people who are not in healthcare, but that they just like enjoy. But I think something that draws people to this is like feeling like they're struggling to stay connected to their humanity, feeling like some of the factors we've talked about the medical legal or the perfection, like they're like, how do I do this? How do I remember that I'm a human? So what advice or words of encouragement would you like to share with them?
So I think that I think maybe a useful thought experiment is, what would I do if I knew that I only had a couple of years left to live? Like if you knew that things were you that and you that no sickness, no illness, you were just gonna, you know, cut it off in like 3 years or 5 years, what would you be doing? And why exactly aren't you doing that now? Right? Like, and really dive down into that. Like, because that might be true, you know? And I actually kind of mean that seriously. And I think, you know, it's 2024. We have so many options. You don't need to be someone who works and works in this model. And I'm speaking for someone who's not in terrible poverty, who has homes, who, I'm assuming like you've at least got a device if you're listening to this podcast. So don't get me wrong. There's lots of issues in our society and lots of people who can't think this far ahead. I totally get that. But if you're kind of the genre that you've just spoken about, I see so many people who they're stuck, you know, and they may not even realize they're stuck, but they're in this mindset where they're like, okay, well, I just have to get through the next 2 years or the next 3 years or the next 10 years of this. And then I'm going to do what I want. Like I just need a little more money, or I need a bigger house, or I need like this or this or that. And, you know, I think the brave spot is to say, what if you just did that now? Oh. And that's something that we all know in theory. It's really hard to practice it, but I think there's something there, you know, that really, if you were going to drop dead in 3 years, what would you be doing? What would you want to have been doing? And why aren't you doing that now? Like, why exactly aren't you doing that now? Yeah. And that's probably what I would say.
I love that. And sort of eerie timing. This morning I was like on a walk and I was like, because there's like, you could die tomorrow. And I was thinking how, I was like, which version of that is helpful for me to prioritize well? Because like die tomorrow doesn't work. Because like you just like drop everything.
Like whatever. Horrible. Yeah.
And like how far out? And I'd gotten to like 6 months. I was like, if I knew I was dying in 6 months, how much more action would I change that? And it felt like a good amount. 3 years may feel even more accessible to more people. So I like that. It's just so funny. I like literally was thinking about this morning. Like,
wow. Yeah.
I'm dying in 6 months. So yeah. Let's see how much I do. So 3 years is another fabulous time interval. Thank you so much. I want to be you when I grow up. I know we're both
like, ah. Well, I don't know about that, but but collect the people that you admire around you, you know, and keep up with them. That's important too. And ditch the people that aren't helpful, because that's it makes a really big difference. It makes such a big difference. And if you're jealous of people, just get rid of them. Don't bother trying to become them. Just ditch them. It's so much easier.
So good. Yes, that is so good. And real, very real. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I am grateful you, to John. Know you.
And oh, I didn't actually say this specifically, but I've talked about it on this podcast, but Sarah and I were soloists together in a concert recently. So, and that was like a core memory.
That was crazy.
Was fabulous.
That was crazy.
We were soloing. And
oh my God. That was insane. Yes. But it was so fun. So fun. Yes. So and fun. It's hard to think of someone else that would have been the perfect person to do that with. So I'm so grateful you were there. That was awesome.
Yeah. The same way.
Right?
That was so great.
Yeah. Oh, it was perfect. Yeah.
All right. Well, for everyone listening,
I'll say too that Joan and I only met during the pandemic, and we basically met online and had only seen each other in person like about three times before. And yet we're fast friends.
Not,
so I was like, wow, Joan is very tall. I had no idea. I pictured you much shorter. And I met her. I'm like, so I'm just, I hate this.
I get that. Anyway, a lot. Sorry. I think because I am tall for like a woman. Like, I'm not the tallest woman, but I'm on the taller side.
No, but you're.
Everyone you meet on Zoom, like, this other group of people I'd only met online, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm a giant. Like, you just don't, you picture them all taller
you just
than
don't
you.
Realize it, right? Yeah, it's like so funny.
Something. All right. Well, thank you so much for all of your time and wisdom. This has been such a delight, and I think will be really meaningful for people to hear. And like, I hope everyone had a pen and paper and just wrote down all the good advice, because there's so much goodness in there. My invitation to everyone listening is really to do that exercise that Sarah said at the end. I think it is a fabulous one. And really can give you a sense, if then you look at what you think you can't do that you wish you were doing in 3 years, then the next question is, what are you not noticing that is under your control, that you think is not under your control, right? Like that part, it's different than you think. It's different than what they tell you, you know? Yeah. So that's my invitation to those listening. And otherwise, talk to you next week.
Thanks, Joan.
I would love to take this work deeper with you. Visit joanchanmd.com today and discover my growing menu of options for restorative medical education to suit your learning needs. I offer one-on-one coaching, customized workshops, and self-study courses that allow you to connect not only with my work on a deeper level, but also with other healthcare humans just like you. So if you want to start humanizing your work in healthcare to a deeper level and do it in community with others, please visit joanchanmd.com and find those options and what fits you and your life today.